It's a pleasure to be your speaker this afternoon. It's good to see everyone that was able to make it back out. Just for a time this afternoon, I'd like to read our passage that we're going to be looking at is over in Acts chapter 22. There we're going to read together. We're going to start at verse 1, but the passage of emphasis for us this afternoon is verses 22 through 30. And I'm actually going to read up to verse 21, and then we're going to pause and then lead into our sermon. If you have your New Testament, you'd like to read along. It's Acts chapter 22. We're going to begin at verse 1. This is of Paul's defense at Jerusalem. It says in verse 1, "Brethren and fathers, hear my defense before you now." And when they had heard that he spoke to them in the Hebrew language, they all kept the more silent. Then he said, "I am indeed a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, taught according to the strictness of our father's law, and was zealous toward God as you all are today. I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering into prisons both men and women, as also the high priest bears me witness and all the council of the elders, from whom I also have letters to all or to the brethren, and went to Damascus to bring in chains those who were even to Jerusalem to be punished. Now it happened as I journeyed and came near Damascus at about noon, suddenly a great light from heaven shone around me. And I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, 'Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?' So I answered, 'Who are you, Lord?' And he said to me, 'I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting.' And those who were with me indeed saw the light and were afraid, but they did not hear the voice of him who spoke to me. So I said, 'What shall I do, Lord?' And the Lord said to me, 'Arise and go to Damascus, and there you will be told all things which you are appointed for you to do.' And since I could not see for the glory of that light, being led by the hand of those who were with me, I came into Damascus. Then a certain Ananias, a devout man, according to the law, having a good testimony with the Jews who dwelt there, came to me, and he stood and said to me, 'Brother Saul, receive your sight.' And at that same hour I looked at him, and then he said, 'The God of our fathers has chosen you that you should know his will and see the just one and hear the voice of his mouth. For you will be his witness to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now, why are you waiting? Arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord.' Now it happened when I returned to Jerusalem, I was praying in the temple and I was in a trance and saw him saying to me, 'Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, for they will not receive your testimony concerning me.' So I said, 'Lord, they know that in every synagogue I imprisoned and beat those who believe on you. And when the blood of your martyr Stephen was shed, I was also standing by consenting to his death and guarding the clothes of those who were killing him.' Then he said to me, 'Depart, for I will send you far from here to the Gentiles.'" Now, since Acts 13, Paul began his missionary journey. He also had Barnabas with him, and as some of the cases, he would use the Israelite history, give a brief history of the Israelites, and he would use that as stepping stones to introduce Christ. And so he does this in his missionary journey with Barnabas. They travel starting at Acts 13 to Acts 14. And he teaches how Christ is the fulfillment of that Davidic promise, having been raised from the dead. And it was kind of like what Roger said this morning. He had mentioned that alone, Christ being raised from the dead, that should have been a sign to all the Jews there who had actually witnessed him being raised from the dead and walking around and speaking with others, that should have been a sign that there's something different about this man and to listen to his teaching. A conflict arose in Acts 15 when certain men came down from Judea And these men came down and they began teaching the doctrine of circumcision by the law of Moses, as it was, they taught that it was still a prerequisite to being saved. And I believe that this scene in Acts 15 of these men coming down and teaching circumcision, I believe that that's an important scene for a number of reasons, but one of those reasons has to do with our sermon today. Number one, it's what is taught on how to be saved that matters. If your path to salvation includes pieces that God never required, things like the sinner's prayer, there's a lot of popular things that are taught today that really don't have anything to do with biblical salvation. And Paul and Barnabas found it imperative. I want you to notice that these people are teaching that in order to be saved, you must be circumcised. And it mattered enough to Paul and Barnabas, it was imperative for them to go up to Jerusalem and to repel that false doctrine with truth, Acts 15 and 24. Number two, this circumcision movement was passed by a sect of the Pharisees who believed, according to Acts 15 and 5. So I bring up these points because several chapters later, in our passage of consideration in Acts 22, if these Jewish believers in the church struggled to accept the Gentiles, how much more do you think that the Jews outside of the church struggled even more? How do you think they would have behaved toward Gentiles? In Acts 22, where our study takes place this afternoon, these Jews listened to Paul for 20 verses without interruption, but the moment that he mentions in verse 21, and he says that Jesus instructed him that he would go unto the Gentiles, that was crossing the line. In verse 22, it says, "And they listened to him until this word, and then they raised their voices and said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live.' Then, as they cried out and tore off their clothes and threw dust in the air, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging so that they might know why that they shouted so against him." So this riot, this mob that has dragged him here, they're now back into full swing, and these Jews may impatiently listen to Paul talk about his conversion. They may even listen to him talk about Jesus, but one thing they will not tolerate is to hear him bear testimony that God now includes Gentiles in salvation. And I, to be honest, I think some of that is lost to us today because, at least, you know, in the church, I think by and large that I don't think that we have that level of discrimination that seems in some places of the world. And so I think that that's kind of lost on us. And whenever we look at that, we think, well, what's wrong with these people? Why would they treat these Gentiles so poorly? And we'll talk about that toward the end of our sermon and the application section. It's supposed that this mob cast off their outer garments so that they would have freedom of motion, and that thus would help them to stone Paul to death. They also threw dust in the air. This was an outward expression of their inner indignation. In their minds, this former devout Jew, Paul, has gone AWOL teaching acceptance of Gentiles under a strange gospel system. And Paul was guarded by Roman soldiers at this time so that they could not injure him, and their only way of expressing their wrath was by these menaces and these threats, by causing an uproar, by tossing the dust into the air, and these were tokens of furious indignation. And we also read, interestingly, in the Old Testament, specifically in 2 Samuel 16 and 13, that Shimei expressed his indignation against David by cursing, by throwing stones at him and his servants, and casting up dust. And so this, I just point that out to say that this is something that happens in the Bible from time to time, and it's meant to show a furious indignation. Their frantic conduct astonished that Roman officer that we just read about in verse 23. It says, then as they cried out and tore their clothes and threw dust in the air, the commander ordered him, Paul, to be brought into the barracks and said that he should be examined under scourging so that they may know why that they all shouted at him this manner. So remember now that the chief captain, this commander, he didn't understand the Hebrew language, and that's what Paul is speaking to them through. This chief captain, he's ignorant of the charge brought against Paul. He's also ignorant of the defense that Paul just made in this chapter. But what he did see is once that Paul spoke about the Gentiles, these people lost it. And so he supposes that something that Paul has done has given them the highest provocation, and therefore he determined that if we will bring Paul to torture, then perhaps he will reveal what he's done that's so bad and find out the true nature of this crime. So this practice of putting people to the rack, it was made in order to have them confess to the disgrace of the human nature, and it has existed in all countries. Verse 25 continues and says, as they bound him with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who stood by, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? Then when the centurion heard that, he went and told the commander, saying, take care of what you do, for this man is a Roman. Then the commander came and said to him, tell me, are you a Roman? He said, yes. The commander answered, with a sum I have obtained this citizenship. And Paul said, but I was born a citizen. The Roman way of scourging was to strip a victim down to the waist and stretch out their arms against a column or a whipping post, and to tie their hands with leather bindings. And then when the beating was administered, it was with a scourge or a leather whip, and it was to use tips that were often braided. It would be braided with pieces of bone or of metal, something that with each stroke of the whip, the flesh is torn and it's mangled. And it's generally believed that this was the type of scourging that Jesus, it could have been at this very post to which they were about to tie Paul. This is happening, after all, in Jerusalem. Moments before this commenced, though, Paul used this as an opportunity to use... He saw an opportunity to use his privilege as a Roman citizen, and by which he was exempted from all trials and punishment that might force him to confess himself guilty. And the manner of him speaking plainly shows what holy security of mind that Paul must have had. As Paul was a Jew in low circumstances, the Roman officer had questioned how that he obtained so valuable a distinction, but the apostle told him that he was freeborn. And this is because in the days when Rome, whenever they ruled the known world, Roman citizenship was a rare prize and it was highly desired because it had great privileges it guaranteed. Paul invoked his rights as a Roman citizen for the second time, and this time he spares himself the pain of the Roman whip. And there were several ways in which citizenship might be attained. McGarvey includes the following information. Just at high level, he says that citizenship was lawfully obtained in three ways. It was granted by the Senate for meritorious conduct. Number two, it was inherited by a father who was a citizen. Or number three, it was the birthright of one who was born in a free city, a city for which may have some special services that they do for the Roman Empire, and thus that free city would be rewarded and with granted citizenship to all born within its limits. And at all points, Paul knew that the God that he served would support him under all sufferings for his name's sake. But if it were not lawful, the apostles' religion directed him, if possible, to avoid it. He never shrunk from the cross which his divine master laid upon his onward road. The last two verses of consideration say, "Then immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him. And the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman because they had bound him. The next day, because he wanted to know for certain why he was accused by the Jews, he released him from the bonds and commanded the chief priests and all the council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them." We are made to feel sorry for this unfortunate position in which Claudius Lysias finds himself. Remembering the dilemma of Pontius Pilate over in Matthew 27, 22 through 24, it's clear that these men of authority often have to deal with the difficult situations that they would, quite honestly, probably prefer to leave alone. Lysias wants to discharge his duty as the commander, but he's unsure what his duty really is. He's gained no useful information from the mob, and he has learned nothing of Paul's speech. And now he decides that since Paul was accused of the Jews, he will call the Jewish council, also known as the Sanhedrin, in an attempt to get to the bottom of the matter. And unlike Pilate, the Roman chief captain was not going to be intimidated by bloodthirsty cries of this self-righteous court of Jewish bullies. And thus we reach the end of our passage. In terms of application, a few points arise, and I'll just go through them quickly. I only have two. This discrimination that the Jews had toward Gentiles, and now Paul, who is spreading something called the gospel, it makes a powerful case that sometimes individuals can become so hyper-focused on maybe a piece or small pieces of the law instead of looking at really what the law as a whole represents. And I'll explain it this way. In the same books that they grew to love, there were many prophecies of the coming one, of a Messiah that would come. And once that he did come, in this respect, they missed the forest for the trees. I mean, they completely missed the boat. It was right there in front of them. And I think sometimes that when they saw the Nazarene, they missed the Messiah. And they weren't focused on God's plan and the whole picture. And so we today, we must be reading our Bibles. And when we do read it, make sure that we're understanding not only the letter of the law and not just following the commands, but we also have to have spirit whenever that we follow those commands. We have to do it with the right attitude. We have to be soul-seeking and look for those that and opportunities that we can bring to the Lord. Christianity is not a list of cannot and just a list of things that you cannot do. Christianity is being able to reflect Christ, reflect his light. It's not looking at all the things you have to give up. Rather, it's being able to shine his light forth in this world and to help those that are lost and dying. Secondly, let us value that freedom to which all of God's children are born. Just like in this case, Paul was born a free person from scourging and from that mob because of his Roman citizenship. Once that we are born in baptism, we get to walk life anew, no longer with Satan's bondage. We just talked about freedom this morning, which no sum of money, however large, can purchase for those who won't leave their sin. There's nothing a person can do if they will not humble themselves and obey the Lord. There's no amount of money you could do to obtain this citizenship. It must be obtained through obedience. And we should value that freedom that we have as God's children. Jesus said it this way in Matthew 10:28. "Don't be afraid of those who want to kill your body. They cannot touch your soul." He says to fear God. I wonder if I'm speaking to someone here today that has not obeyed the plan of salvation. Perhaps there's someone here today that needs to believe. If you believe that and you repent, you confess and you are baptized for remission of your sins, you have an opportunity to do and follow these steps and you can live life anew with Christ. Perhaps I'm speaking to someone here today that's already obeyed that plan. That's the vast majority of us here. And if you stand a guilty distance from God, you have sinned, you would like to make right, you would like to confess it and leave it behind, we have an opportunity here and now. So if there be one of either case, please come and let it be known as we stand and as we sing.